This podcast is a member of the Red 5 Network. For more Red 5 Network podcasts and content creators, visit bio.link/red5.
We might as well start the show, Heidi. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Fantastic. I am so glad to see you. I am so excited about this special Scarif Live, and we're going to have some fun.
Absolutely.
So I wanted to ask you, because we've had quite a relationship with Prop Store. It's been a wonderful little collaboration. We've been treated to preview some awesome props and costumes. Costumes, obviously, up your alley. Props, I love movie props and stuff like that. So we've had some really great shows with Prop Store. What were some of your past favorites? What were some of the elements of the shows that we've had in the past that that you really remember?
Oh, well, the Leia gown, of course, her ceremonial gown, the plunge neckline that's so beautiful and that they restored. Mm-hmm. And probably Arya Stark, her needle was very cool, that just went up for auction not too long ago. And anything Blade Runner.
Right. Yes.
Because you know that's my favorite.
Right.
How about you?
Well, anything Star Wars. I know they just had the Anthony Daniels collection, but even before that, we had some really wonderful Star Wars props. Leia's gown, beautiful. C-3PO's hands and his head. Mm-hmm. Anything having to do with Star Wars, I am all in. I've got my own collection behind me, as you can see, but absolutely nothing as awesome as something that Anthony Daniels actually wore on the set. So those are some of the, you know, really awesome pieces that Prop Store has had available for auction. And yeah, maybe, you know, if I win the lottery or two, we can kind of chime in and be able to bid on something. But you know what's cool is that you don't have to be rich or a lottery winner to be able to kind of log on to the Prop Store website, take a look at the catalog, and then just kind of run through it. And you know, every time they sent us that link to the catalog, it takes me days and days and days to go through it because they have a lot of wonderful stuff.
They sure do, and they do a really beautiful job of like taking photos, and I've oftentimes used Prop Store to, like, if I'm doing a video and I'm looking for some really nice photos, it's because they take photos of all angles, and then they do really great descriptions of what the, like, one of the things that I had talked about is John Mollow, who had auctioned off his family had auctioned off his drawings. I was so delighted to see that they had actually taken such beautiful photos. So it kind of broke my heart a little bit that the family decided to auction off his artwork, but at the same time, very happy to see. And of course, Brian, we got that beautiful book. Brendan, I apologize, sent us that beautiful book on Star Wars costumes that he signed for us.
I love it. I have it handy right here. Case. I love it. Love it. Absolutely. Yeah. So we have another show with Prop Store, and we have been teasing the featured posters that we are going to talk about in a couple of minutes with our guest. But there's a couple of favorites that you picked that are also favorite of mine. I think we're kind of like killing two birds with one stone. Not that I condone that sort of violence, but we are really going to have fun with these.
Absolutely. Well, yours, the ones you chose, I, you know, I was like, oh yeah, those are awesome choices. And so then I sort of went in and kind of behind you and chose the other ones that I really like. But I think we'll probably all like each other's.
Excellent. Looking forward to, we are going to bring Gray Smith out right after this. Let me push a couple of buttons and refill my drink. We'll be right back.
This podcast is a member of the Red 5 Network. For more Red 5 Network podcasts and content creators, visit bio.link/red5.
Is now the ultimate power in the universe.
And let's see here. Where is Gray? Is right here. Welcome, Gray Smith, to the Scare Scuttlebutt Podcast.
How are y'all? Thank you.
Very good, very good. Thank you for joining us on this special.
Thank you.
Is this special midweek edition of the Scare live show? We only come out for special people, and thank you to you and Prop Store for joining us.
Well, happy to do it. Thank you so much. Looking forward to your questions.
Yes, absolutely. So, I wanted to start out a little bit with a little bit of history on movie posters per se. Gray, do you have any tidbits for us as far as I guess the start of, like, who thought of movie posters? How far back does it go?
Well, they really go back to the turn of the 20th century. I think they more or less developed out of theatrical posters. You know, theatrical events were printing their own posters, and the size of those posters, as are most all of the one sheets, what we call one sheets, like those behind me, were all developed by the size of the litho bed in that period, which was around 27 by 41. And so ultimately, everything else sort of developed out of that. You know, they printed bigger posters, which were called 3 and 6 sheets. But those were typically developed by a 3 sheet. You'd turn a 1 sheet on its long side and stack them. And that's how they printed them. So it goes back, and the smaller formats developed all shortly thereafter, what are called half sheets, insert, lobby card sets. So it really does go back well beyond 100 years for film posters. Yeah.
Yes, I hear I hear Heidi clicking away.
Oh, sorry.
No.
I was trying to share this out.
I did find a little bit of some history. Like, it goes back to like 1890. Some French artist named Jules Charest.
Yeah. Well, that's stone lithography was sort of developed by Charest. Okay. And that was the first real color photography. And, you know, I don't want to go into, you know, too deep into the weeds here about all of that. But yeah, he really was a real innovator in printed color photography. Okay. And before the early mid 20s, all of the film posters were done in what's called stone lithography, which was a process in which they would use 3 or 4 stone runs that would overlay each other to create the full color. So offset lithography developed pretty fully by the early 30s. So, yeah.
Interesting.
Great. Can I ask you a question? So, you said that originally they were used for theater, which, you know, like the marquee and I guess and everything, and then later film. So when did people start putting them up on their walls? So, because I know, you know, as a teenager or even maybe younger, I would always have posters up on my walls. So when did that sort of become a thing?
Well, I did the same when I was a kid, when I discovered them. I think that really poster collecting was really in its infancy in the 50s. You know, I, amongst a lot of us collectors that have been doing it for many years, we always said, well, gee, if you were really actively involved in collecting in the 50s, you could have probably found almost anything, because the poster exchanges still kept that stuff. And they had it, you know, sort of put away often. I think probably it really came into its own in the 1960s. You know, college dorm rooms, what have you, people started saying, gee, I want to see if I can find a poster for Casablanca to put up in my college dorm room, because that's when, you know, television was so instrumental in educating all of us to old film. And so that was, I think, the evolution of collecting them to put on your wall.
Interesting. Yeah, I had posters in when I was in high school, although they weren't movie posters. They were like Daisy Duke and Farrah Fawcett. That doesn't count, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, I guess it does. I mean, why not? I think that, you know, all of us, I think as young people, we just wanted something that we thought was inexpensive, we could decorate our bedroom walls with, or our dorm room walls or whatever. So really,
yeah. And then the fold out poster, like, was that, do you know what year that sort of came into, you know, where you buy a magazine and there would be a fold out poster that you could open. And I know I had several of those that I would.
Yeah, I remember them. I don't know, Heidi, when the advent of that development in publishing came about.
But I mean, they would have creases. That's the only thing.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So did all theatrical posters, essentially one sheets and bigger sizes up until generally the late 70s, early 80s, and they quit folding them. They were machine folded back in the day. They'd come off the press, they'd machine fold them, and then they'd distribute them because it was so easy. They could put them into the film can with the films, essentially. So
wow. And I do remember, yeah, I do remember in the 80s you had posters that were in Starlog magazine and all those, you know, Fangoria. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I remember, you know, trying to take them out carefully and then, you know, unfolding them and stuff like that. You know, we had a lot of great movies in the 80s, a lot of great movie posters as well. But do you want to start taking a look at some of the movie posters that we have selected, Heidi?
Sure. Do you want to just put one up and we'll talk about it?
Absolutely. So the first one is one of your choices, which I think we're going to start out strong with this one.
Yeah. Nick is saying that's an interesting nugget. Glad posters are not folded up now. Yeah, it's true. Because when you buy them, they're in like a cylinder in the store. Like they put them in a display case that way.
Yeah.
Well, absolutely. I wonder whose poster this is.
I will venture to say that this is your favorite or one of your favorite movies, Blade Runner. And it is such a beautiful poster.
Yes. And I had this on my wall when I was a teenager, because this came out when I was 16.
Yeah, it's great John Alvin art. And it's, you know, they only did the one style. There was no advanced teaser or anything like that for this film, which I think is kind of odd because it was a huge, hugely budgeted film. And usually you'll find things of this period, they do an advanced teaser, they might do two teasers, and then they do a standard release or two. But this is the only really known for the U.S. release style. They did, I believe this is a national screen style, but they also did the studio style, but it was the same art, essentially. So,
yeah. It looks like these are not photographs. It looks like they're paintings or artwork.
It's all artwork. It's John Alvin, the late great John Alvin. It's his art. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So Gray, did he do? Was it just movie posters he did, or did he do album covers, or what kind of artwork would he do?
I think John Alvin developed his style initially with doing album covers. Other potentially publication illustration work, and got into film poster work, and remained there and did just tons of great stuff through the years. I mean, his resume, if you will, of posters just reads like a who's who.
It's just stunning. I remember as a kid, because I used to do a lot of drawing when I was younger. And of course, I love this particular style. Like, I don't know if it's, it looks like it's hand painted. I'm not sure what his technique is, but
multimedia. I mean,
multimedia. Yeah. And it was one of those. Yeah. But I like you say, I don't remember, like, because we're going to be looking at Star Wars and there were several versions of that. But we only had that one version. But you know what? We have perfection. Why change it?
Why do more?
Why do more? Exactly. And I'm trying to remember, because I have the Blade Runner here. This is my collector box. I have of the Blade Runner. I've got like the director's cut. So I'm not sure. I have to check in there to see if they have the poster on the cover. But anyway, such a beautiful poster.
I love when movies, when you release a movie collection like that, Heidi, that sometimes they'll put in some extra stuff and then they'll mm-hmm. have like mini posters or a little mini cards or lobby cards and stuff like that. So it's you know, a lot of people collect those. Sometimes they're called the steelbooks, but the big case, the large collection of movies, especially if there's more than one movie. But I love all the extra stuff that they put in those collections. And the mm-hmm. mini posters are great.
Now, can I ask you just to not like it, like just not about the Blade Runner, but mm-hmm. so great. What is the average price that a movie poster usually goes up for auction? I mean, obviously it depends on, you know, how rare it is and everything. But like, so as Ro was saying, if you're just getting into collecting and you think, hey, this might be a way I'd like to get into collecting, what can someone expect to pay for posters?
They just come in all prices. I mean, it's kind of like asking me how long's a piece of string. I mean, I will say that you can, you know, if you're careful and you, you know, study the market and what have you, you can make some great buys in generally more contemporary films. And when I say contemporary, I mean 70s, 80s, 90s. But they're out there. And what's more, you know, theater owners have kept them through the years. So right. There are still great finds out there. But, you know, just if you wanted to, you know, a couple of $100 is sort of a starting place for a better, more collectible poster. But it just goes up from there. So, yeah.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And Heidi is from Canada. So a piece of string is a little longer up there than it is in the United States we use the inches.
Yeah, we have the metric. We have the metric system. That's true. Actually, we get better deals when we buy fabric.
The metric system, the system we never got a hold of.
Yeah. So we do get a bit extra when we buy fabric up here, Reed or Gray. Sorry.
All right. So I've got one of my selections is The Bride of Frankenstein.
Oh, yeah.
And I there's something about these older vintage movie posters. First of all, the orientation on this movie poster is a little different than what you usually see. It's a little bit more square and wide than it is, you know, tall.
Format. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I love the layout and the I guess the special layout of this particular poster. It's not like full complete edge to edge, but you've got some details on the edge. You've got the bride over on the far left and Frankenstein on the bottom there. And, you know, a cleaned up bride on the far right side with a little, you know, electricity, as a That's design element.
That's Colin Clive's wife in the film.
Oh yeah.
Frankenstein's wife. Yeah. Valerie Hobson. Yeah. Yeah. So that's called border art mm-hmm. on lobby cards of this period. They had wonderful border art on these things. And
yeah.
So it's lobby card collecting is a big, big part of the hobby and has always been, these things have always been sought after. They came in sets of eight.
Oh, wow.
There was a title card generally, though some studios like Paramount did not produce a title card, but the other studios generally did. And they had all, it was like full art with the titles. So it was like a little mini full poster. And then the other seven would be scenes from the movie, such as this. So
this particular poster almost looks, like colored in. Was it originally in black and white and somebody and the studio colored it in, or is this the original release?
Everything was, all of this was shot in black and white in the day. These weren't usually, the lobby cards were not produced from screen grabs or shots from the movie itself. They had a still photographer on the set, as was always the case and still is. And so they would take those photos, which were sharper, sometimes wouldn't be exactly what you'd see in the movie, but they'd have to colorize them and, a process to create, to make it look like a movie, a color movie. And that's what always fascinated me with these lobbies and the one sheets and everything, because they put these things, these beautiful posters like those behind me out in front of the theater. Well, the movies were all in black and white. I mean, generally up until the mid-30s when they were started experimenting with them. And so you'd go by this poster and it'd be in full color and you'd think, you could just imagine, you know, oh my God, this is going to be great. And of course you got into the theater and you knew what to expect. It was black and white. Yeah.
Wow. It's too funny. Yeah. You're muted.
Sorry, guys. I think sometimes also the artist who paints in the color, they sort of created the color that they liked, because I know at least with costumes, sometimes the outfit is a totally different color.
Oh, yeah.
Like
yeah,
when
yeah.
you look at it. Yeah. So I always thought that was really kind of neat.
One of the famous examples of that is the lobby card set to Rebel Without a Cause. There wasn't a title card by that time. Warner Brothers wasn't doing them. But there's this portrait shot of Dean laying down on his back at the mansion, the scene. And Natalie Wood's in, has her face right next to his, sort of, you know, consoling him. And he's in a blue jacket. And we all laugh and went, where's the red jacket?
Yeah.
So that's.
Yeah, I did a deep dive on his jacket. I know it's sort of fun. But at the same time, the one thing I did like about black and white is that sometimes you can just imagine like what the color would be. You know, you could decide that for yourself. So I always thought it was neat that the artist would create what they would think would look nice. So,
well, it was to draw people into the theater, of course. Sure. So why would they produce something in black and white when they had the ability to produce these brilliant posters? So.
It's almost like the Han Solo Hoth jacket controversy. Is it brown or is it blue? You know? So that's too funny. Our next poster is a Heidi Select. And going back to the horizontal layout, we've got the Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Again, just I love just these older vintage posters. There's so much action going on here in this one.
Yeah, this is called a half sheet. And it's done in the same format as the lobby card and on the horizontal. And this has taken the name from collectors through the last 40 years. They call this the spotlight dance.
Oh.
And a little something about this is that the rest of the poster campaign was produced with like a red background with a yellow hand, imprinted on the, you know, like an imprint on the poster, and you had McCarthy and Winters running or what have you on the poster. But this is the only one, you know, other than the lobbies, that showed a different sort of a variation on the artwork. And so this is really very, it's unusual. It's much more scarce than a lot of the other paper on this film. And it's always been a sought after poster by especially science fiction collectors.
Sure. Sure. Heidi, why'd you pick this one? It's a great selection.
Well, it's one of my favorite black and white films. And even though it was in black and white, it's terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. I know a lot of people.
I had nightmares as a kid about the dog running down the street with the man's head.
Absolutely. And even though people always cite the Donald Sutherland one, this one, I couldn't believe how terrifying it was. And I love the colors in it. I think it's just beautiful. And I love the typography of the Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I think that's just.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? It really is.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. Gray, you were saying that the half sheet, so like, how would they have frames outside? How would that work in outside the marquee or whatever? Well, like, how would that work when the
outside and inside, they would have frames for the inserts, which are the long rectangular ones, and the half sheets, as well as the one sheets. A lot of times the bigger posters, such as the six sheets or three sheets, they would glue them on walls around town.
Okay.
And that's why so often, pardon me, those posters are much more scarce. Well, first of all, they didn't print as many of those big formats because they found that the theater owners didn't order as many. Mm-hmm. But they're much more scarce, and they're very impressive in those large formats, like a six sheet. I mean, really impressive. So, yeah.
So why do they call it like a six sheet?
Because it takes 6 1 sheets, essentially, you know, put together. Now, they didn't print them like that by the time, you know, you got into the 30s. A six sheet consisted of four panels that you'd put together. And a three sheet would become two panels. But in the day when they were producing stuff just on the single size litho bed, they would produce them in many panels. So a billboard.
And would they put them up?
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, would they put them up sort of like wallpaper?
Yeah.
Like, can you see these guys like with the brushes?
I remember as a kid behind a theater in our downtown, they had a big board and it sat probably 18 feet off the ground, 20 foot. It was a big board. And every time the movie would change, three times a week, they'd go in there and they put up a six sheet. And I remember as, you know, just a little kid driving by going, wow, that big poster.
Yeah. And
they would just put one on top of the other. They probably wouldn't even peel them off, right? There'd be layers and layers.
Till it became too much and they just scrape it all off and start again. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Like the big thing now, I don't know if you guys have seen this in subway stations. They do, I think they call them wraps. They just completely cover, you know, something. The tiles.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
With large format.
And it's called wilding, essentially. When you take a poster, and some posters were intended to just be wilded, they'd slap glue on the back of them and put them anywhere, you know, construction barriers and that sort of thing. And, you know, there's a controversy some years ago about how many posters were printed and what was a print run, because a lot of these studios like Continental and Morgan didn't keep numbers. Mm-hmm. And the speculation was that they had to be in the many thousands. I mean, you know, 10,000 or more. And people go, well, there weren't that many theaters, really. I mean, not that would show that one picture, you know, because the studios owned all the theaters, or many of them. There are many. And the thing was, well, no, they sold the posters to a theater owner by the hundreds, so they could take them out and glue them on every surface in town.
That's why you see post no bills now, because it got out of hand, I guess, right?
That's a big part of it. People were just taking those posters and slapping them up everywhere. There was a famous story about a guy who was hired as a kid to go out when Birth of a Nation was all over the country. I believe it was Birth. And they gave this kid 200 posters to go out and post everywhere. And he got lazy and he didn't want to do it. And he wanted to just, you know, go do something else. So he took 150 of them and wrapped a stone around, or put them around a stone and dropped them in the bottom of a lake. And, you know, a Birth of a Nation poster now is worth $75,000, $100,000.
Wow.
You know, Heidi, that sign, post no bills, used to confuse the hell out of me when I was a little kid. I used to think that you could put bills there, but not posts. It's like post, comma, no bills.
Well, you were thinking.
I was thinking.
Great. One of my favorite hobbies is watching like hoard finds. And sometimes, like, so has this happened where, you know, they've gone into someone's house and it's like, you know, there's a treasure trove of collectible posters in there. Has that ever happened?
Yeah. There are all sorts of finds have been made, and there's still a lot more to be made out there.
I'm thoroughly convinced.
But people would go in and renovate a home, and they tear out the walls and find the posters used for insulation.
Yeah.
Or they pull up the old linoleum rug or carpeting in an old house and find. I had people call me with those finds, just incredible finds. And it's a lot of fun because, you know, most of these posters, like if they've been under flooring, they're going to be dirty. They're going to be soiled, probably some staining, but they can be restored. The techniques for restoring posters is so great now. So, yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I was going to ask you about that. That's fascinating. Fascinating. All right. So, another one of my selections. And again, I'm just really fascinated by these older styles, and this one is a very particularly unique shape.
Yes.
It's the insert.
Okay.
the press books used to call them insert cards. They were printed on a little bit heavier paper stock than one sheets. They were like a card stock. And generally they were folded after they were used more than once so that they could ship easily, but not always. Sometimes you find them rolled and that's a premium. But yeah, this is just one of those wonderful kitschy science fiction films, a Roger Corman film at that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just, I really fell in love with these when I was a teenager, the science fiction stuff. I just thought there was nothing better because I love the movies. So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a theater in one of our close suburbs, and they have a little coffee eating area, but they have a huge, huge, huge wall. And on that wall, they've got all these type of posters, and I love it because it's the ceilings are super, super high. So if you can imagine a 12 foot poster stacked like, you know, five times, it goes all the way really high, and wow. They look really impressive.
That's great.
All sorts of different posters. It's great.
That's wonderful. Can you tell me where that that place is?
Yes, exactly.
I want to take a note on that. And go see them.
And a pickup truck?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, I love all those vintage posters. My selections are mostly the older vintage ones. There's something about the artwork that is so different. And I know, you know, each period of posters, starting from the 30s and 50s, you've got different ages of movies, like the golden age, pop art when it comes to the 80s with some of the imagery here. But something about the older style vintage posters are so great. And again, I didn't live in the 30s, 40s, 50s. But some of these movies are just they work on a weird collective subconscious when it comes to nostalgia, and they look great. They feel great. I think we're all connected to cinema in some way, whether you're a child of the 80s or you are a moviegoer from the 50s. Something about movie posters really resonate with movie fans in general. Don't you agree?
Yeah. I really do. Most people, again, I started collecting when I was a kid, so I just loved them. And when I found out I could buy them, I just went crazy, doing everything I could from mowing lawns, etc., to go buy posters. Yeah. But I think a lot of people just didn't realize or never really gave it much thought that you could buy them. They thought they were just, only for a theater owner, and you couldn't really own those. And I just think I was very fortunate in my youth to be exposed to the fact that there were people out there selling these things. And I think it's a wonderful hobby. And, you know, it's really, for all intents and purposes, if you compare it to things like, of course, coins or comics or just, you know, books, etc., it's a small hobby in many ways. It really is. So it's... I think it's still in its infancy. So
sure. Is it a small hobby because a lot of these posters are rare and unfindable?
I think there's something to that. Yeah. But I think if you get bitten by the bug, you're going to, I'm sorry, I've got a family
it's
member.
It's a kitty.
She is very demanding.
Pay attention to me, Dad.
So cute.
Yeah, that's right. I think that, I kind of lost my train of thought. I think that once people get bitten by that bug, they'll really try and seek out whatever they can find. And it doesn't always have to be something terribly vintage. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes it could be something that is a little more unique. There weren't that many of them printed, et cetera. You know, because when you go overseas, and I don't want to go, you know, too deep in this, but some of the smaller countries, their print runs were much smaller. And you get into something like, you know, Great Britain, where they printed far fewer British quads and double crowns. And some of those things are really quite scarce. And so it's a real treasure hunt in all respects for all countries. So, Sorry if I got a little long-winded on that.
No, actually, I was going to ask you. That's a great point, Gray. I was going to ask you. So, you know, because we're all the things that we've picked at are English language, but there's probably a market, I suppose, for people who want foreign language posters, like a Western film that has, like, maybe it's Japanese or something. Is there a market for that? Like
so, Heidi, and you know, there's kind of a consensus within the last 25 or 30 years that the Italian poster artist, generally just before and post World War II, their work was just fabulous, brilliant, beautiful. And so in that respect, those posters have really taken on a lot of interest by collectors now, because there's the U.S. just couldn't produce anything close to it after the Second World War generally.
Yeah.
Is there like Fellini, that type of thing, or
yes, but for all, you know, they released all of the American films over there after the end of the war. And so American films, you know, you'd find a poster for a film that, where generally the U.S. poster was a little lackluster, but the Italian poster would just be fabulous. And in that respect, they've really gained a lot of, collectability.
Yeah, absolutely. Before we go to the next poster, I want to just acknowledge a couple of people in the chat. Nick, his favorite posters are Jurassic Park and Jaws and Raiders of the Lost Ark. We're going to talk about that one in a second.
Jaws is iconic.
Skywalker Academy, hello there. Jesse is here. Somebody we see in our chat all the time. Ubaldo, thanks for stopping by. Let's see. Anybody? Am I missing anybody? No. So a great bunch of people. And yeah, so have Heidi and Gray, have you seen the new Dune yet?
Of course, no, I yes.
No, I'm sorry.
So I have not either, but here's the, this is the, a signed poster from the original Dune back in what? 1994,
84, I believe. 84. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
who's it signed by though? I forgot to, for Phil.
Yeah. It's funny because we spoke about this before we went on the air, that the guy who had the sign was a studio marketing guy. And I was sort of saying, should I say his name or not? But I think I won't, just for privacy. But he had it inscribed to him. So, yeah, by Lynch. And this is, by the way, the advance poster. One of the advance posters is called the Two Moons poster, is what it's referred to in the hobby. And it is a good bit more scarce. I mean, it's not really rare, but it's good bit scarce than the, I think there were two other styles produced in the U.S. As general release posters. But this one, as you can see, there are no titles on it, stars, etc.
Right.
So it was an advance, or what's called by many a teaser. Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you, because I think now in the 80s, we start to see alternative posters, where maybe before the 80s, we don't really see a lot of, you know, B style and C style as we come to know them. Was that a thing where they started to make these advanced release posters, like a teaser, and then you get the full poster like later on? Was that a normal practice?
Well, not really. I mean, you know, if you look at press books from the, well, at least from the 30s into the 40s as well, there were teasers produced in those days. And many studios produced two styles in the 30s and 40s. It really just kind of depended upon the studio. MGM was real big about it. Universal did that. You know, Universal, they're great horror films. A number of those had a teaser poster, like The Invisible Man or Frankenstein or Bride of Frankenstein. So they had several styles for those films. So it really wasn't a new advent in the 80s. But of course, I think with printing becoming cheaper, et cetera, they probably, more of it has happened. But I find now in this day and age, there aren't as many styles. You know, they have a photoshopped poster and it'll be one style in many instances, and that'll be that. So it's kind of fluctuated, I think.
Wow. Yeah, what I like about that poster, Ro and Gray, is that compared to the new movie, and I was going to ask you also, Gray, you probably find that, you know, when you get a new group of fans who watch the new show, then they're like, oh, let's go back and watch the old show. And it sort of brings out, you know, people become interested in it. But I love it because the new one, the Villeneuve one, is very just neutral. And this is just so bold and colorful. And I just love that.
Yeah, yeah. I remember when the film came out and I found that teaser and I thought, oh, well, this is the best poster for the title by far. I mean, and it's just a personal opinion.
Totally. And I could be wrong, but I feel like that they've used that for the DVD cover. Cause I was like, sure. I think that's the, and I'm wondering if sometimes they do that, like for reprints, if they sometimes use the poster design for the DVD or the Blu-ray.
Yes. I'm sure that they salvage a lot of that older art to you. I mean, why wouldn't you?
Of course.
It's all there. So, yeah.
Yeah. And that is one of the things that interests me about movie posters, the style of we have minimalism. Folks in the chat are talking about Jaws. So it's very recognizable. You've got the shape of the jaws of the shark coming up from the water and then the text, but very minimal design. A movie like Alien, where all you see is the egg and the one line that says in space, nobody can hear you scream. So those are very powerful images, the minimalist posters. And I love those because they, like if you're decorating a home, like something like that would almost act as design elements or elements that kind of lead your decorating, because it's they're great.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. And they're great. Just, you know, really inventive and wonderful. Yeah. You know, Castell's Jaws, and those things are just they're so iconic now. I mean, I think that's what's so drawing for people to them is, you know, to get a Jaws one sheet, you know, you just immediately want to put it on your wall because it brings back the horror of seeing that film.
Absolutely.
I remember seeing it when I think it was my freshman year of college, and I was just amazed by the thing. I walked out, just really, it was very, you know, just, well, I mean, I don't want to get into critique of the film, but the poster, I remember vividly seeing it and going, wow. Sure.
Yeah, because we don't even really get that perspective. Yeah, sorry.
Right. You walked out and you definitely did not want to go to a beach, right?
No, not generally, but I didn't live near one, so I didn't have to worry about that.
Wow.
But it was that opening scene. I mean, of course, still sticks with all of us. So,
yeah.
Yeah. Because my thought about it was like the size of the shark, but they have the woman swimming at the top.
Right. She's so small.
And you're like, oh my gosh, how big is this shark? The scale. Yeah. And then they don't even show it in the movie. So it's really only in the poster. So what I loved about that is that whoever designed the poster, it was their imagination of what it would look like under the water.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, in essence, remember when they reeled him up on the ship? It was five times what a normal shark would be.
Good old Bruce
needed a bigger boat. So
that's right. Apparently, that line was ad-libbed.
All right. So Heidi mentioned foreign posters, and one of the ones that I really enjoy, for some reason, I like any vintage poster that is a Japanese version of the original. I think the Japanese character, the language is so beautiful. And Gray and I were talking about this before we started. The layout is wonderful. Gray, talk a little bit about, you were telling me a little bit about the Japanese style of movie poster production.
Yeah. Well, the Japanese really came into their own in the 50s. I mean, late 40s, 50s, with this sort of photo montage that they used. back in the 40s, early 40s, and into the mid 40s, it was typically artwork. But they started this photomontage design that they used, and it was so brilliantly done. And throughout the 60s, some of the Japanese posters are just so far and above the U.S. posters, I think, especially when you get in the 60s, because they had this very innovative photo montage, sans Photoshop. And it was great. And I love these posters. They generally are about the size of a half sheet on standing vertically. And so they're easy to frame and gorgeous. So, yeah, I just think they were so brilliant in their design.
Yeah, they're beautiful. Laid out really nice. I love the color. And again, you know, these are the type of posters that if I had like a really nice, like a huge loft with a big wall, these are the types of posters that I would love to display. And Gray, I just have to, I was reminded by somebody in the chat, it is Heidi's birthday today, isn't it?
Oh, wow.
Yes.
We're doing yay, I get to spend thing. It with you guys. Yes. It's not a milestone birthday. It's not a fancy birthday. It's just a, you know, another year.
Well, she's finally 21. I can take her out for a drink.
Yeah, there you go.
I'm legal. Yes, I can drink now.
That's wonderful.
Well, yeah, I love. Actually, I was going to ask you. It's interesting with that Japanese poster that they mm-hmm. still do have the English language on there. Is there a reason for that? It says yeah. picture from the Black Lagoon.
Yeah. Well, they would do that. Okay. And I mean, I think that was. I don't know. It'd be a little presumptuous of me to say because of the fact that the American population over there in the 50s was probably fairly strong after the occupation. That
makes
that
sense.
They felt it was appropriate to do that. But I have sold a number of them from this same time frame that didn't have the U.S. title on it. So it kind of varied. So, and they produce an export poster as well often, which would be more in the English language than otherwise for Japanese films. So, yeah.
So far we've taken a look at some older posters, some vintage posters, and Heidi had a question towards the beginning of the broadcast talking about taking care of the posters. I mentioned that I have a friend of mine who was an artist, and I bought one of his artworks, one of his pieces. And I must have spent more money on the frame and the glass to protect this piece of work that I spent on the actual poster. What is the best way to take care of these wonderful, wonderful pieces of art, you know, from these old movies? Like, is there special, what special things do you need to keep in mind when you
frame them? Yeah, and I'll say there are two real damaging elements to movie posters. Number one is sun, because it'll fade, and you want to prevent your posters from fading. So when you frame them, you want to use either museum glass or OP Plex and keep them out of direct sunlight. Even if they're in OP Plex and whatnot, if you've got them in direct sunlight, they will fade eventually. But water is the other, of course, damaging element. I mean, I don't want to go into fire. We all know that. But any sort of moisture, like greater humidity than normal, what have you, where it could create mold, it's a problem. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of the really vintage pieces, 100 years old or more, some of those things were printed on a fairly acidic paper. And so they'll start to break at the folds and whatnot. And that's the time when you probably want to send it out to a known professional restoration person who can wash the poster to deacidify it and lay it on linen. Now it's called linen backing. You see a lot of posters that are linen backed. Some people prefer, you know, just don't want anything that's linen backed. But I always say, if you've got really vintage posters, it's almost inevitable you're going to have some. But the term's an old term anyway, because they don't really use European linen anymore to back them. There are other things, but they are on it, like a cotton duct and Japanese paper. And what it does is it just preserves them from, you know, darkening and becoming brittle, et cetera. So there's all kinds of there's all kinds of things for sale that you can store your posters in that are archival and will keep them in good condition for, you know, the rest of your life while you're the caretaker and before you pass it on to someone else. So, yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. That's fascinating. The ability to be, to restore some of these older posters. It's you would think that, like, you use the term washing and also yeah. in the same breath, you said that anything water or liquid is damaging. So like my brain is like, what?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what they do is they submerge it, the poster, in a, an alkaline buffer to some degree I'm not a restoration person, but I've been mm-hmm. around a lot of it sure. in my life. And they'll then be able to pull it out of the water and put it onto a piece of Japanese masa paper, which is completely inert, no acid in it. And they kind of squeegee it out to where it's just totally flattened on the paper. And it's, you know, it's really brilliant. I mean, the people that know how to do it well are just true artisans. I mean, I don't have any qualms myself. If a poster is brittle or fragile or whatever, I'll get it linen back. Why? Mm-hmm. Because I'm going to save it for another many, many years.
Sure.
I have posters from the late 20s, 30s that are folded and some on my wall. Well, you know, why fix it if it ain't broke? That's what I say. Yeah. So,
yeah. Yeah. And sometimes you have to pick your battles and see, you know, which ones are worth the effort and the expense.
The expense. That's right. Yeah. That's a big part of it. I've always said part of my job is the question is to restore or not to restore.
Right.
You know, it really is. Yeah.
Gray, I was going to ask you if a poster gets moldy, because, like, I don't know, like if people store stuff in their basements, is there any rescuing it once the mold is in there?
Well, it's difficult. I mean, and I'm not an expert on this, but I know that I have found posters that have pink mold on them. And what it does is essentially just makes the paper disintegrate. So if you go to wash it, it's going to just float away like that.
That's really a shame.
So there are some, you know, some mold can be controlled, I think, and contained and restored, but some cannot. It just, you know, anywhere that mold was where the paper just disintegrated, you could still choose, if it wasn't a, you know, predominant part of the poster, to put it on linen and repaint the image where it was gone. So, and I've seen a lot of that done.
Interesting. All right, we got another Heidi pick, and this is a good one.
Yes.
Logan's Run.
Yeah.
And before we started, I asked Gray, is this two posters or is this just one poster landscape? But Gray, what do you have to say about that one?
Yeah, it's two posters. The one on the right is what's called the teaser or advance. And the one on the left is a standard release. It's got the Charles Mall artwork. And it's great. I mean, I like the film and I like the posters. There's a little too much white on them for me to really be completely in love with, but I think they are, you know, very sort of indicative of the film, the artwork. And I really like the one on the right because it talks about the, you know, the elements of the world they're living in. So
right.
Yeah, that showed at the very beginning in the movie because my son says it's like a bit of an info dump they do there.
Yeah,
right? I said, well, you know, like they got to get a bunch of information out really quickly, right? So
yeah. Well, it's, you know, I mean, and maybe they printed the poster so to save people time when they went in, you know.
Yeah, and again, I think it's the DVD cover. If I'd have to double check that, but anyway, I absolutely love it. I love the font. It's one of my favorite fonts.
Yeah.
Yeah. They use for the title.
Yeah.
But
it's fun. It really is. And
I think it's really fun.
Movie was fun. Yeah.
You can still see the, you can see the folds on this one.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And Farrah Fawcett is very, you can see Farrah Fawcett there quite well, actually.
Right.
With her flip hairstyle.
Yeah. I bet both of these were folded. I mean, it's really hard. You know, there's a new trend amongst collectors, which has become more prominent, to want to find rolled copies of posters, even into the 70s. And as you know, we mentioned that they're fairly scarce from the 70s. Finding rolled posters is a, you know, just adds a greater demand for them. So it's really nice to get rolled copies, because not until the early mid 80s were they prevalent. So yeah. Sure.
Yeah. And now, you go to Target and you see all those rolls and they're just, you know, posters and stuff like that.
Yeah. Which my son just got one the other day.
Yeah. Which reminds me, I have to put a rolled poster in the mail for a contest winner. I keep forgetting. All right. Heidi, you were going to say something?
No, I was just going to ask, Ashley, speaking of that, Gray, like if instead of framing, do you have a recommendation just with a modern poster? What's a good way to put it up with, like, I know a lot of people use the sticky stuff, the tacky stuff, instead of using push pins. Do you have a recommendation?
I wouldn't recommend that. They make some relatively inexpensive frames now, really.
Sure.
I mean, and I think that, you know, you can probably buy a one sheet frame now for 20 or 30 bucks. And that's,
yeah, like what, I know IKEA sells them.
Yeah, that's what I would do.
Yeah.
I
mean, is that what you do?
Well, I don't myself. Oh, Ro, I'm sorry.
Ro, oh, sorry.
Yeah. I mean, when I was in high school, yeah, and I didn't have more of a disposable budget, no, I would use stick pens, or I'd be one of those guys with glue and do this. No, but now, like I said, I spent a lot of money on the frame for my friend's art. And one of my favorite Empire Strikes Back posters, it's a large one sheet. I have to remember what the name of it is, but it's got Darth Vader up on top and he's holding the lightsaber, and the Empire Strikes Back logo's in the middle with some stuff happening on the bottom. But I spent a lot of money on that one too. And that one's probably my biggest poster.
You get hard to frame in those big sizes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas Gray, the ones behind you, I'm assuming you had those custom framed.
Yeah. I have. Yeah. But they're, you know, a little bit more pricey posters. So I didn't want to put them in a $20 frame. So.
Exactly. Do you ever swap out your posters? Like every once in a while, you're like, oh, I want to pull it.
Yeah. I do indeed. And, you know, I'll do it just kind of on a whim from time to time. I look around and go, oh, I think I'm going to trade that out. I've got something else I want to put into it. And I'll send it out and it'll be gone for a few weeks. And then it'll come back and I'll put it on the wall. And somebody coming through the house, my wife or kids, when they come to visit, will go, huh. You changed it.
Like, you changed it.
Like,
you can change your decor, like on a whim. Well,
it's fun. Yeah, it really is. You know, they make frames now where you can keep it on the wall and just snap the sides down. You put in a new poster and put the plex over it and snap them back. So I always thought that was kind of a nifty idea. But
In the future, our walls will be lined with LED displays and we can just kind of dial it up. And change them. So that would be
that's what I've said for years, is posters will not be produced in the future.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you don't see them at the movie theaters really anymore, do you? Like they just have the LED even outside
Sometimes,
of the
they're on their way out.
Now I was gonna tell you though, Gray, when I went to see the new Dune, they were handing out posters to attendees. They were small though. They were small.
Yeah. Yeah, and they, you know, the studios are doing that now, producing the little smaller, kind of like, I don't know if I want to call them teaser, but they're different artwork. And those things sell pretty well because, you know, people just think, oh, that's different. I'd like to have that. Yeah. So those are
yeah, it's a nice collectible to have.
Yeah. Yes. I agree. Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to put up another one of my picks, and I wanted to talk a little bit about, because I know in the comic book world, people really love not only the comic books, but certain artists. And you've got posters like this that from Raiders of the Lost Ark, where it is, this image is just iconic. Besides the font, but obviously you've got the depiction of the character Indiana Jones here as played by Harrison Ford. And obviously, you know, the character is iconic. The art in this case for this poster is also equally iconic. But talk a little bit about this one, Greg.
Well, it's Richard Amsel art. He's no longer with us, and he did a lot of great artwork for posters in his lifetime. I think he died rather young, but it's a fabulous poster. And again, I remember the first time I saw it in front of a theater, and it was, you know, just totally eye catching. Hadn't even seen the film, but I thought, wow, what's this about? With the little vignettes on the side and bottom. I think it's just a absolutely brilliant image. And of course, he catches Harrison Ford just dead on in likeness. So I wish I knew where this original art was. I'd love to have it.
Wow. Lucasfilm Archives, maybe?
Could be. Something tells me maybe not. I don't know why, but I think it may have been offered in the private market about 30 years ago or more.
Oh, wow. Sure. Wow. But that's interesting.
But I've always liked this poster. And of course it's highly collectible because the film is so universally acclaimed.
Yeah.
This one in particular, you know, the sequels, the posters, at least the second two ones, they're collectible, but not like this one.
Thinking it's funny that we have Harrison Ford is in three of the posters that we're redoing.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
Maybe two.
You can't escape him.
Yeah.
I wonder what it's like for an actor just to see a giant marquee of themselves, like a giant, you know, that must be really weird.
I mean, especially now since Harrison Ford is up there in age. To be able to see yourself, back in the day, because I mean, how many fans of either Star Wars or Indiana Jones still see Harrison Ford like this? You know,
I do. I had a poster of him on my wall, like just from the film, like a poster from the film, as opposed to, so Reed, are those, sorry, I don't know why I keep calling you Reed. I apologize. Gray. So aside from the movie posters themselves, what about, still images from the movies? Are those
commercial? We call them commercial posters.
Commercial posters. Okay. Because I had a picture of Harrison Ford from Raiders of the Lost Ark on my wall.
Well, they don't have as much demand. And I'll tell you why. It's just because people want a little piece of that film. Mm-hmm. And having the theatrical release poster is part of it. And I've always said that poster collecting, you know, especially when you get into vintage material and whatnot, you've got a little piece of that film that existed when that movie came out.
Sure.
And with commercial posters, they were generally printed in far greater quantities. They sold them at places like Spencer's Gifts, I remember. And, you know, so they just don't have the demand or, you know, draw that a theatrical release poster has, at least from my experience. So, yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. Let's see here. We saved the last two, the best last two here. So, and it's funny because, Heidi and I did not, confer with each other before we made our selections. And it seems like we are within the same nerd family. So it's wonderful that, we're able to do this. Heidi picked, this little movie you might have heard of.
Oh yeah, that it kind of came and went, didn't it?
Yeah.
It was a bit of a bomb.
Yeah.
But this poster, this version in particular has something special about it. Gray?
Yeah, this is a printer's proof. And this is the Style A Tom Young one sheet. But it's a printer's proof, as you can see by the color bar on the left side. And these are far more scarce, of course, than the general release posters, because only a certain number of them were produced so that they could be shown to the decision makers. That's generally how this was done. They were proofs that were taken to the marketing execs, the studio execs, etc., so that they could see what the finished product was going to look like or not look like. Because if they got it and said, well, we don't like that, we don't like the color, we don't like this, we don't like that, then they change it. Mm-hmm. But this was something that'd be sort of like hot off the press, you know, a press proof of a book or anything. And I think they're really fascinating, and you find them for different films, but they're far, far more difficult to find than a standard release one sheet. And this is for the first printing. It's got the little zero down in the lower right. You know, there were four printings of this Tom Young poster, and this was the first printing, and it's a printer's proof of the first printing.
Wow. So when these proofs are done, are they just for the printers and the decision makers, or do they go to circulation? Yeah, yeah. And they
were never meant to, they were never meant to be put into circulation.
Oh, no. Wow.
No.
And Prop Store has one?
Yeah, and they come to market from time to time. There was a printing company called Gore Graphics, and they printed most of the Star Wars posters in the day for the original trilogy. And they obviously had put a few of these away. And so some of them have come to market, but they're still much, much harder to find than you would find a first printing of the just general one sheet. And most of those general first printing general one sheets were folded. So finding it rolled is an added bonus, as is these proofs.
Wow.
One thing I like about the poster is in this case, because compared to the one that Ro, you're going to be showing, is the costumes. I love it because it's very, well, it looks more like her second outfit, which I thought was really, really cool. And then Luke has this like plunging neckline, which with the muscles. So that was why I love this poster so much. It was funny because we were talking about Logan's Run earlier, the men all have this. It was very 70s to have like plunging necklines for men back then. So I just sort of thought it was, I don't know. Do you know anything really why they decided to style it this way? Was it just an artistic choice?
Well, I don't have any real background. I think the artists like Tom Young were probably asked to produce these very quickly. I'm not sure why. I know the Hildebrand brothers did a version of their own, which they were asked to produce in 24 hours.
Wow.
And they used the Hildebrand art in Great Britain, if I'm not mistaken. But another little fact about this style, a first printing one sheet, is they were knocked off. Sometime in the 80s, somebody apparently went to the printer and they created fakes of them. But the beautiful thing was that there were telltale signs of the fakes. So you can tell them now pretty readily when you see one in person. And one of the telltales is a little imperfection or flaw. We call it a hair, but it's just a mark that's in Skywalker's belt. Uh-huh. And so whenever one of these things has come in front of me, I'll open it up and look at it and go, well, that's a fake. So you know, so it's a lot of them still out there though. And a lot of people I'm sure have been duped into spending good money on what was not an original poster. Yeah.
And yeah, I remember Carrie Fisher. Oh,
sorry, go ahead.
I remember Carrie Fisher saying, I wish I had a body like that.
I love it. Yeah. No, cause I was going to say, it reminds me of Frank Frazetta. I think it is Frazetta who did a lot of the, the pulps. He did a lot of the sexy, style. So I don't know. Cause so the other one is more realistic, but I just sort of think this is so fun.
It is. Oh, and it's probably one of the most recognizable Star Wars posters. Mm-hmm. Really.
Yeah. And what I think is interesting is the fact that they didn't really, they didn't go so realistically, and it makes it, I think, that much more interesting in a way, because they didn't really know what they had. They were just, let's get some art out there. Right. And I think that's one of the the great thing about, you know, these certain early illustrations that sure. it was kind of an unknown. They just thought, well, it looks good. Let's do it. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Is there a museum for posters? Like, is there anywhere in the world where you find like famous posters?
Not really. I mean, of course they should be.
Where?
And that's one of the things that posters have really been underappreciated in the art world for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the French were the first people to have poster museums. They weren't less necessarily cinema poster museums, but those were going on in the 19th century. They were really the first big poster collectors. But there's, you know, I mean, the Academy has a large collection. I don't think they display many of them. Every now and then they will. But not a real, I take it back. There are, you know, LACMA.
LACMA, yeah.
They have posters and display them. But nothing that I'm aware of, and people are going to have to forgive me out there. There probably are some places that have standing exhibits of posters all the time. But I'm just not familiar with them off the top of my head, so.
Yeah, there should be. I think it's poster art for sure is, like you said, is underappreciated. I think a lot of movie fans in general really would like to be able to go somewhere and appreciate the art and the work that was put forth. And really just kind of, you know, it's kind of like a time capsule, too, of, you know, movie houses back in the day, et cetera, et cetera. So,
yeah.
You know, the old Michael Jordan Steakhouse here in Chicago on LaSalle is empty, waiting for some investors. So Gray, after the show, if you're ready to talk business, we can set that up.
Let's see what we can do. Okay.
All right. So speaking of Star Wars, one of my favorite Star Wars posters, and I hear that it might be George Lucas's favorite as well, is this wonderful piece. And mm-hmm. I think in general it's called the carnival style poster.
Well, it's technically called the style D. I think people do. I think there are several names for it. Carnival style is probably as prevalent as anything. But it's a great poster, and I agree with you. It's really my favorite because it's sort of a collage of two different artists. And what happened was the center image with most of the artwork was produced, but they realized they didn't have enough for the credits. So another artist did work around it to leave that box for the credits. So it became, you know, a poster that looks like a poster that's been wilded on a wall.
Yeah.
So really brilliant. Yeah.
I love it.
I think it's fantastic. I love that Chewbacca's kind of peering out in the corner there in the bottom there.
He's like, where's my medal?
Exactly. But the addition of Obi-Wan on the wood there really adds some incredible depth to the visual of this. And you see the, you know, on the top, you know, corners there, the peeling off on the wood. I love that.
Yeah. It looks sort of like what you would expect somebody to have come along and slapped a poster up on the wall, and somebody else had to have maybe peeled or pulled another poster off on the lower left. Mm-hmm. I think it's really wonderful. And I think it was just a really great idea to not scrap that original art and, you know, move forward with I thought was an innovative design. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And this artist is highly sought out. Drew Struzan.
Yeah.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And Charles White was all the other artist for it. So yes.
Absolutely. Like I said, it's my favorite poster. And actually one of my favorite artists as well. I think he retired because I had asked him if he wanted to be on the podcast and talk posters, but, he politely declined.
Did you reach out to him?
Yes. Yes. He says, I'm retired.
Oh, that's so cool.
Aww. He's retired. Yes. As I understand.
Oh my gosh. That's so nice though.
Yeah. good for him. So we've got some wonderful memories from him. But yeah, any final thoughts on vintage movie posters? I also want to give Gray an opportunity to tell us a little bit about Prop Store and when that auction is coming up.
Well, I appreciate that. Yes, the live auction is next Thursday and Friday. It begins at 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time in L.A. on both days. And there's about 350 lots approximately, maybe slightly under, in both days. And I just think it's a really fabulous selection. It really is from all genres, all ages, countries, etc. It's I just very proud of the selection. So
yeah, absolutely.
Join us, please. Go in and register for the auction, which you must do before the beginning. But register. You can proxy bid now, and of course can participate during the live event.
Awesome, awesome stuff. Heidi, any final thoughts on posters?
You're muted.
Sorry, I keep doing that. The other one I was going to say before we leave, I also love, was the Rita Hayworth. I think that's the one that's on the cover of the catalog.
Yeah, right. Yeah. The Gilda style beat.
The Gilda one, yes.
Yeah, it's a great and classic image. It really is. I mean, that poster's been, you know, sought after for 40, 50 years. And of course, being a great film noir, it's classic, really is. So
yeah.
Absolutely. I put the link, Ro, but I might need you to approve it just to the auction if anybody wants to go check it out.
Sounds good. Yeah, we'll put it down there. I'll hit the little edit button and we'll slap it in there if it's not in there already on the YouTubes there. But great. Thank you so much for joining us on this edition of the Scarif Scuttlebutt podcast. Like I said, you know, Heidi and I have been very fortunate and appreciative of everybody over at Prop Store that has have given us the opportunity to check out some of these wonderful auctions on props, costumes, art, and now posters. So it has been a fantastic ride for us. Well, a wonderful collaboration.
Thank you so much for having me. I really have enjoyed it, and so nice to meet the two of you.
Oh, thanks. Excellent. So much, Gray. It's been such a pleasure talking to you.
Yes. Yeah, same for me. All right, then. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And we will catch everybody in the chat. Thank you guys for joining us. I hope you guys had a good time and learned a little bit about vintage posters. And don't forget, hit the link down there, register. And you don't have to be a millionaire to bid on some of these posters. They are really, really great pieces of art. Yeah. And as usual, my little saying at the end of every show is don't forget, it's always sunny on Scarif. And that's the Scuttlebutt. Talk to you guys later.